Hi everyone. First of all, I'd just like to say thank you for everyone for coming. I know IFRS 4 is riveting for some, particularly my panel members over here. More about them in a second, but it's not that way for everyone. And as ever, we always seem to get this slot in the afternoon session. At least it's not immediately after lunch, but people aren't always the most wide awake at this point. So to try and address that, I thought this year, instead of just being a dry update of what are the latest of developments and some very sort of technical sort of jargon flowing around, it might still be dry because I've got actuaries on the panel, but what I thought is I would invite a bunch of practitioners to talk to us about what are they actually sort of seeing with the developments and give their perspective, their views on developments, and then how things are progressing and what they're sort of doing. So with that as background, first of all, I need to do some introductions. So first of all, myself, I'm Peter Tripp. I'm a director at Deloitte, and for my sins, I've been following IFRS 4 for more than 10 years. I'm a bit of a black sheep within our actuarial practice for that. Admittedly, I still don't know the difference between debits and credits, so that's my defense. I'm still an actuary. But then my panel, who will be actually doing the hard work answering the questions and talking to you this afternoon, we've got representatives, and I'll describe them. I don't want to spend too long on introductions. Basically, I'll describe them all as valuations actuary-type people from the big four companies. So we've got Henny Miller over here from Old Mutual, Henny van Wyk next to him from Sanlam, just to confuse you, so the two Hennies right next to each other, then Michael Fuchs from Liberty, Quinton Crayling from MMI, and then closing out the panel, I've got Ray Bennett, who's a director in our Johannesburg practice, and specifically Ray will try and help, you know, sort of give some perspective from the smaller companies in the industry. And then a special guest or mention at the end is Jeremy Menzies, who's a director in our Hong Kong practice of Deloitte, to provide an international perspective on what companies are, what are we sort of seeing globally, are people actually doing anything, do they think anything's going to happen on this front at all. So that's their background. And our time's relatively sort of constrained, so Ray's going to sort of jump up every now and then if we start straying off or if I'm not keeping to time too much. The general format, as I said, is I want to sort of cover the practical things. We're going to sort of start off with what do you actually think about? Is this going to happen? And if so, what are you doing about it? And then, you know, some questions about understanding the efforts, that you think is involved. But I think as a bit of background before we get into that, because not everybody's following it that religiously. We do unfortunately have to do a bit of medicine and cover, you know, some of the terminology and technical side of things. So I promise I'll just keep it. I think I've got three slides just to give a recap before I sort of lob the questions to the panel. So I think I've got the right button, the green one that says forward. Or if the remote doesn't work, you guys can maybe shift it forward yourselves. I promise there is more than one slide. They're not all the same. Sorry, technology guys, are there any other remotes or is there any help? Okay. Right. Okay. Is somebody going to go and get that shortly? Shortly. Okay. So I'll kick off without a picture. The first slide is the usual timeline one. You might be familiar with it. Just giving you some sort of background, you know, reminding us that there was an exposure draft in 2013. There have been a number of sort of questions, you know, that have been directed that the ISB wants sort of covered, and I think in my view, or quite a few people's view, a lot of those questions have been largely sort of answered. So that's one of the questions I want to sort of lob at the panel, is whether they sort of share that view that we've addressed most of the conceptual sort of blockages. Then another sort of crinkle in the works has been IFRS 9, the new accounting standard for financial instruments, as was issued last year with effective date in 2016. And just, you know, that is going to, you know, goes hand in hand with the financials of an insurance company. It's the asset side of you. You know, we're used to looking after the liabilities. Just very recently, an option has been granted for companies to potentially defer implementation of IFRS 9, or this is insurance companies. So just the question is whether that's important in our lives. Do we care about something like that? Just the implementation date, you know, the timeline. The ISB says or estimates that they'll get the final standard out next year and will give 3 years for implementation. So you're looking at a January 2020 as first-time implementation. You know, so again, that's going to be sort of a question as whether we believe that's going to be met. Bearing in mind, well, I'll leave something else bearing in mind. Then the next slide, I don't know whether this, probably not working yet. The next slide is also a different version of the timeline thing, but it's more of one of those like project plan things. And here it's sort of saying, you know, if we believe that this is going to be implemented in 2020 and we've got to have everything in order then, working backwards, what does that mean? What is the impact for us now? So, you know, we might want some things, I don't know, not everybody might want these, but maybe you want a parallel run so before you actually switch everything on. You know, got to think about that. You know, maybe also you've got to think about sort of testing. Then there's sort of transition on the initial, you know, first balance sheet that you prepare. You've got a complete sort of change in liability, and you've got a lot of sort of questions around, different approaches, different assumptions to use. Do we want a large sort of profit to come out of that in-force portfolio, or do we want something smaller? So lots of questions around that. And then also, if you think about it, if you work backwards from that, that means you probably need a lot of this in place by 2018. Okay. So I'll do the next one. Okay. I think we've kind of caught up. So you're working backwards. You probably need a lot of your infrastructure in place by 2018 to start doing some of these things in time for 2020. And even before that, you need to probably need to be doing budgeting and forecasting for your various sort of stakeholders. So it's 2020 might sound like a long time away, but maybe it's not. And again, I want to sort of get the panel's sort of perspective on that. Right. That's, I think, enough of me. No. There's one more. The building blocks approach. Just to remind you all, similar to Sam in some ways, you've got this best estimate cash flows with discounting, with a risk margin to reflect uncertainty, but then sort of topping it up is this new concept, the contractual service margin, which basically mops up any profits at inception, so no profit is recognized at inception. That doesn't mean no negative liabilities. Because I think there are some views that, that sort of sets your liabilities all to being zero, at most, or at least. But actually, as you sort of step past your initial point, that your remaining liabilities can actually sort of, well, your liabilities can go negative, but I'll try not to get too I'm staying away from technical. I think those were the key themes I wanted just to sensitize you to before handing over, to the panel members. So, I've already used a lot more time than I'd planned, so without further ado, maybe starting with you, Henny, what are your views? Do you think it's actually really around the corner? Are we going to get it next year? And what are you doing about it, if so?
Okay, well, firstly, I'm probably still a bit skeptical about whether the standard will actually be released next year. And the reason I'm saying that is the new variable fee for service model that's been developed for participation contracts. My view is just that the criteria to use that model is very strict, and I do anticipate that a lot of participation contracts might not be able to use that model. And I'm very worried that there might be some big insurers in Europe that might start lobbying for something else, and then there's a kind of a potential further delay in the final standard. But that being said, I do think it's probably the right thing at this stage to start planning towards the standard being published end of next year and get your house in order. From our mutual perspective, we've done quite a lot to come up with the project plan, working back from a 1 January 2020 date and looking at all the resource requirements, looking at systems changes and using that to inform a project budget over the business planning period. So I do think it's probably at this stage quite difficult to work out what the profit impact will be as a result of the new standard, but it's clearly significantly easier to start thinking about how much it will cost you to implement the new standard and starting to allow for that in your IFRS profit projections and potentially also even in your embedded value calculations. I don't think we'll start a formal project until the IFRS standard is released, but we certainly planned a lot of work over 2016 already. I do think we'll look into the new concepts introduced by the standard, like the contractual service margin, and also the optionality that the new standard will provide. The standard is very principles-based, so there's definitely certain areas where you can have a different interpretation from another company. And I do think it's important that you at this stage apply your mind to those options that are available to you and to make the right long-term decision. Over the last 2 years, we've had an internal working group at Old Mutual, a group of actuaries and consultants that we expect will play a key role in the implementation of IFRS 4. And the main purpose was just to kind of look at how the IFRS standard will impact our main product groupings. So we did a lot of that, and we've also conducted a lot of awareness sessions and education sessions with our financial management in the different business units, and also had sessions with our product development teams and balance sheet management, just to make them familiar with the new standard also, so that they start allowing for that in any long-term business decisions that we take now, that you don't make kind of any decisions now that along the line you kind of felt it's maybe not the right decision then. We've also been quite active in lobbying certain issues that we see that needs to change, and either directly with the ISB board or through SAICA. And yeah, maybe that's kind of what we're doing at this stage.
Yeah. Okay, no, that's great. That's, I think, a lot of really sort of good points. So, I mean, Henny, you know, from your... Well, Henny van Wyk, this sort of time, always got to sort of clarify. You know, so Henny Mullum, you know, made some sort of comment, you know, made a comment about, you know, at the moment don't really sort of have a full-blown sort of project, you know, sort of structure in place. Again, with a view to, you know, do you think, you know, things are sort of happening? What's your perspective on setting up projects and some of the challenges around that?
No, I think very similar on our side, although I think we're a little bit behind as far as the project is concerned. We haven't really looked at a product plan or cost on, as far as that's concerned. I think we will really wait that until the final standard comes out. I mean, if I were a betting man, which luckily I'm not, I would have lost a lot of money on whether the standard would ever be implemented or not. I was wrong for many years. I think this year was the first year I was right. I said they would not get the exposure draft out this year, and I was correct. We are worried that because of the major changes they've made to participating contracts that they might have to re-expose the draft again. I think there's definitely a possibility, in which case I might be retired before they actually implement it.
Yeah, I think that's a common theme of quite a few actuaries. I think Andre's got it right. But Quinton, I mean, your views on, you know, sort of getting buy-in you know, for project and sort of commitment.
Yeah, I think we've probably experienced the same kind of attitude within the group, within our group. Without a firm standard and without a firm date, I think there's always something more important that we can apply our resources to, and up to now that has predominantly been consumed by SAM. But I suspect as the dust of SAM is now starting to settle and it becomes part of our business as usual, we will probably start wanting to do something else over weekends. And and this this will probably be the next big thing that will consume us. So I think the first thing is probably to get the buy-in from the board and executive management, just that this standard is not a theoretical thing anymore. It's on its way. There's maybe some tweaks coming, but yes, we probably do need to start escalating it.
And Michael, from Liberty's perspective?
I think for Liberty it's largely been the same. It's difficult to get momentum without a final standard. And I think we've taken the view that until a final standard, the main part that we'll play in here is to do active lobbying and contribute to field tests and that to try influence the direction as we think it should be. My view of it, they will expose, or they will have an exposure draft next year. Just more for formalities, I think they are going to, they pretty much know all the issues, but because they've changed it so extensively, I think they just want to double check that they haven't missed anything. But I think they've heard all the debates, they've heard all the lobbying, and I think they'll push it through so that it's launched by 2000, or that it's in by 2017 and you have to implement by 2021.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite a scary view. It's almost, okay, we've heard everything, no further sort of changes.
What is the political risk of that?
Yeah, sorry.
I think the problem is almost the reverse political risk is that they keep on deferring. I think they've lost so much credibility from that. I think this project is already on wobbly grounds for IFRS.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, great. Ray, from a smaller company perspective?
Yeah, for me, I guess a lot of the smaller companies would be in a similar boat where they don't really want to commit to doing anything until the standard's finalised. But I have seen two companies who looked at it already. One has done a gap analysis to try to see what the impact will be. And another company actually, because of their specific circumstances, they were trying to adopt it, I think, earlier this year. So I think there's varying levels of readiness, but on the whole, I don't think many companies are doing too much.
Okay, and then Jeremy, just to a global perspective, are we alone in our views here?
not really. I mean, the level of involvement and attention that companies are paying towards IFRS 4 in Asia does vary as well. So some of the very large companies are spending some time and effort on it, but again, some smaller ones are sort of still trying to grapple with getting Solvency II over the line for their head office if they're a multinational corporation, and in many cases they're just waiting for head office's direction. Interesting in terms of timing, so there was an ISB board member in Hong Kong for a presentation a little while back, and he did tell someone in our firm that they were still confident that they would get all their decisions made this year, which you know, is, we're almost there now, so I'm not sure whether they'll be able to make what he said, but he said as long as they get it decided at the end of this year, it would be another 6 to 7 months to write it up, and it should. He was expecting the standard to still be out mid to late next year, largely because of the political reasons. I mean, they just need to get it out now. A lot of them are just sick and tired of dealing with this, and they just want to get something done, I think. In terms of lobbying, so some of the large companies have banded together to lobby to the ISB through letters as well, and Actuarial Society of Hong Kong also recently wrote something to the ISB covering a few areas like indirect PAR, as Henny mentioned, so that's an area of concern. The volatility in earnings that will arise with that potential method, unit of account, discount rate. So if the yields or the bonds available in the market aren't long enough, they want to be able to have a long-term rate that you can sort of trend towards year to year, and also the unlocking of CSM, having a locked-in interest rate to roll it up. So we wrote something on that. On the large companies who are actually starting to do something, we're seeing they're doing business impacts, and that may be 2 to 3 months worth of effort, sort of looking at all kinds of impacts of it on the operations, on the systems, HR impacts, future-proofing projects that they currently have in force or that projects that they have online to come through. And in general, the sort of thing that we're saying and that the message that we get from these companies after they've gone through it is, you know, it's best to start early, start small, and just plan and investigate and take your time to get through it, because if you try to do it in a rush, it may come... It may be a big surprise, and when you get to 2019, 2020, there's not enough actuaries in any of the markets to be able to do this, because everyone's doing IFRS at the same time, apart from the US. Mm. What else? Some companies have done financial impacts, high level again. Some companies have just dived straight in and said, right, we want you to study how to do a top-down discount rate calculation, which just jump straight in from a market where interest spreads or negative spread is a real concern. So depending on what the market is, they have different concerns as well that they want people to start looking at. And the other thing would be training. So even within Deloitte in Asia, I mean, we put together a training pack for not only the actuaries, but also for the accounting, IT, all the different parts of our practice that would need to help clients in the future to implement this, so that everyone knows what all the different terms means. And then after clients hear that we've been doing that, some of them are actually saying, well, can you come and give that boot camp to us as well, because we know that it's not just the actuaries who need to know about this as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that's also consistent with the, you know, sort of starting early, developing some awareness. I think we've seen a common theme, you know, with most of the companies here as well, developing working groups of experts, you know, to keep apprised of it, and then also, you know, sort of starting to sort of spread, you know, some of that information. But I guess that's the next step, is, you know, sort of widening that sort of base. Just out of interest, I had thought of using the voting technology, but it has sort of escaped me. So maybe if I can just put you guys all on the spot, who thinks the standard's actually going to come out next year? Come on, Ray, put your hand up high. So what's that?
50-50.
Okay, typical actuarial sort of stochastic voting. Yes. So I don't know, I'd say, what's that, probably like 2 out of 6. So it's like roughly, I think, is the sentiment. So if we don't meet, you know, next year, what does that mean? Michael?
I guess it means the same as it's been the last few years. This project's been extended quite regularly. I think it just makes it more difficult to actually get management on side, get the board on side, that there's lots of work to be done here and we need to get started.
Yeah. I mean, are there any particular constraints if we push it out much more than next year?
No, not really. I mean, I think things, it's not like IFRS is completely broke and we've got other measures. I mean, it's not like as an industry we're pleading for a different basis. I think this was very much a project to try get global consistency, or at least with countries that follow IFRS. But as a South African industry, I think IFRS as it currently is meeting its requirements.
Yeah. Okay, so, I mean, I think that's enough sort of background on, you know, sort of our views on getting sort of going. You know, that earlier sort of slides sort of showed, you know, quite a few years worth of, you know, potential effort in there. You know, so one sort of question I sometimes sort of hear from people is, well, we've just done SAM, you know, what more do we need to do? It's got the same building blocks. So is it as simple as that? I think maybe Quinton, starting on your side.
Yeah, I think we're definitely in a better position because of SAM, but I suspect that the differences will be quite significant, and the challenges that we will face, in particular, I think, in terms of the performance measurement, so the income statement, is something that didn't feature prominently under SAM. SAM was very much, or is very much, a solvency or balance sheet focus, whereas the IFRS is, although it's got the same building blocks, it is definitely a performance focus. So I think the challenges of that shouldn't be underestimated. The involvement of actuaries to populate the income statement, something that just can't just be extracted from a ledger, is also going to be a challenge from almost a softer perspective in terms of the interaction and the structures around the working, the way we work between the accountants and the actuaries. So I think there's going to be a lot more of those types of softer issues that will have to be managed.
Sorry to sort of interrupt you. I mean, it might just be useful just to give very sort of high-level sort of description of, you know, what does the revenue sort of account actually sort of look like, you know, because you're saying there's big sort of change there. You know, so what is, does premiums not appear on the income statement anymore? Do claims not appear?
Yeah, so in my view or my current understanding is that the income statement will become very much more like an analysis of surplus. So you would revenue would be defined differently. It would not be defined in terms of premiums, but rather premiums earned, simplistically said. So these metrics all exist within the actuarial models. So they are there. We currently produce them as part of our embedded value reporting and analysis of surplus. But the accuracy, the time, the robustness, and the speed with which this flows into the financial statements is, I think, where the biggest challenge will be. And I think one area that should definitely also not be underestimated, where SAM was maybe slightly lighter than IFRS, is the fact that this standard will apply to all our subsidiaries, so even our African subsidiaries. And I think that challenge should not be underestimated, the data and requirements involved with that.
Yeah. So, I mean, Marco, I mean, you obviously also have lots of subsidiaries knocking around. Do you echo some of Quinton's feelings?
Very much. I think the biggest challenge relative to SAM is SAM, as Quinton said, was very balance sheet focused, which is typically the area actuaries have played in anyway, whereas here there's a large income statement component, and if not well built and automated, it's going to be very difficult to audit income statements. Also, it's going to become more and more that the accountants rely on the actuaries for almost the whole income statement, which we're not really used to. I think there are potentially clever ways to automate it, that almost the accounting system can be fed with the correct feeds and that it follows a very similar principle than currently, but almost what you define as premium income and that will change. So my understanding of it, for example, premium income is not as we define it now, but is very much more what are our charges. So what are the contribution charges? What are the risk fees we take? So not all the other components of premium, which is very different to the way we've been currently seeing it.
Right, right. And Henny van Wyk at Sanlam, I mean, is this going to be a big challenge, this rewiring of the income statement?
This is one area where we are quite lucky that we are, I think, ahead of the curve. In our actuarial systems, that is really the way we've looked at profits for many, many years, probably about at least 30 years. So that is the way we've always looked at profits. And in the last number of years, our group finance people have actually implemented a new financial system where they actually get that into the financial statements, into their system. It has been in the financial statements for a number of years that we actually show our profit as financial services income, less commission, less expenses, less underwritten benefits. So for us, the pipeline is there to get the information through. We also don't have a problem with the fact that we need to know what the investment component is when a policy dies. We actually have that, and we've had that for 30 years. Since we implemented Universal Life, which was in 1985, if I remember correctly, it's 30 years. So I think that part for us, the pipeline is there, but obviously the information we have to give through will be slightly different, and packaged in different ways. So it's a question of just packaging that differently from the actual system and giving through to the financial system. So we're quite lucky about that one. We think the profit models that we that was changed for SAM is also a good start for what we need. Obviously, tweaks are needed, and the one thing that is the most interesting part is what you do with the contractual service margin, which you probably want to calculate in profit. Otherwise, you have to do it on a spreadsheet on the side, which obviously is not a good thing and not really auditable.
Okay.
So but just to say, to get that information, if you're starting from scratch into a financial system, is a lot of work.
But I mean, it sounds like sounds like you're feeling quite happy with a particular position. Did that take quite a bit of effort to get into that sort of state?
The project to get all of that information into the financial system was a two-year project.
Yeah.
And that was, but I say, at least the actuarial part was done before that.
Yeah.
But for the changes we had to make and some of the other people had to make to get in there was a major project. Yeah.
Right, okay. Great. So we've heard about, sort of impact income statements, sort of revenue, some of the technology sort of aspects. Any other sort of areas, Henny Miller, any other sort of areas where you sort of feel, there's going to be some impact? And maybe just give us also your overall sort of assessment. How much work is this compared to SAM?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't be surprised if it's as big as SAM. But I do think it will depend on how important your IFRS profit is as a KPI measure for your business going forward, and how important it is in your investment case to investors. So I do think you can take one of two extremes. The one could be just to do the regulatory minimum and just do the minimum to comply. Or the other end could be that you're trying to get a competitive advantage through your financial reporting by providing information that's more meaningful and useful to users. And clearly that's going to come at a greater cost. So I think that's quite an important question to management to think about. Kind of what role is IFRS 4 IFRS profits on the insurance contract going to play in your future investment case? And is it the right model to be the key KPI for your business?
Mm. Right. Okay. And any other impacts, do you think, from product development or other business aspects?
I think, as I said, I do think there could be potential impacts on your hedging strategies that you currently use to hedge certain aspects of volatility to your IFRS profits. And clearly, with the new contractual service margin, I do think there's going to be more smoothed profile to your future profits. And you certainly will need to kind of relook any of those strategies. Yeah.
Right. Okay, great. Raymond?
So for me, I think companies just need to realize that unlike SAM, there's no sort of proportionality or shortcut. So I think the effort's going to be similar no matter how big or how small you are in terms of Quinton's point with the subsidiaries. So I think that's quite a key thing for companies to bear in mind.
Yeah, so that's actually something that we've seen as well. So we've worked with some multinationals who had, 10 or more operations within Asia. And the thing we found is that, it didn't matter how big some of the smaller entities were. After they'd worked through the business impact analysis on each of those entities, they realized that there's almost just as much work for those small entities as the big ones if they're operating in a federated type model where each company is allowed to do actuarial modeling or accounting the way they want to do it locally. There may be benefits if you have some kind of shared service center where it's a common process used across the region, then you can probably get some leverage for building an IFRS solution that can be used regionally, but some of the players have opted to have this federated model to give more empowerment to the local entities, and that now is sort of beginning to bite them in the bum in terms of effort required on IFRS. I guess looking at it, so I think you're comparing to SAM. I guess I could compare to, say, something like Solvency II. So again, you've got a bell, you've got some kind of risk margin or risk adjustment, but under IFRS you need to be able to disclose what the confidence interval equivalent would be for the risk adjustment. So even if you use the cost of capital method, you still need to then calculate what it would be if you were to present it as a confidence interval. And you also have the CSM in terms of actuarial modelling. But then there are other things that come out like this. the unit of account, the level at which you do the calculations, contract boundaries may change. You have this investment component that you need to strip out in this source of earnings analysis. So every death that occurs, you need to know what the surrender value was for that contract at the same time. So there's a lot of information that's needed. You need to change admin systems, you need to change actuarial systems, you need to change sub-ledgers, ledgers. So it goes all the way through all the different systems from what we've seen. And so the income statement and SOE-like analysis, I mean, a lot of companies do that, but generally not to a level that you could pass it to an auditor. So a lot of them are done high level in a spreadsheet that won't cut it when it comes to audited financial statements. Mm-hmm. So they need to actually industrialize the process. Yeah. So that's going to require a lot of effort, I think, and having databases of all this information so you can drill down when needed. What else?
I think that's comprehensive enough.
Okay.
But I mean, maybe just to sort of close it out, because I mean, the overarching sort of theme is, you know, the extent of sort of effort. So again, to put you guys on the spot, sorry, it's not secret voting, but if I put a hypothesis out that overall, it might come in different shape or sub guise, but overall, do we think this is similar order of magnitude? Not necessarily exactly the same or more or less. Similar order of magnitude as the effort put into SAM? Yes? Okay. So fairly consistent theme there. Okay, I promise not to try to keep it not technical. But one particular area where I think quite a lot of work around modeling and, you know, sort of decisioning needs to be made quite early on, as I warned in that one sort of timeline, is around transition and developing, you know, one's liability at, you know, at initial, the first balance sheet date that you create. So again, I just wanted to pick the panel's sort of brains on their thoughts of some of the challenges around that transition approach. So I think we've probably got just less than 10 minutes that we can cover on that sort of topic, and then that sort of gives us about 10 minutes for questions from the floor. So, Michael, transition.
Transition's a tricky one because they've given various approaches to do it. One's the most accurate type of approach, but from a system point of view, may be very difficult to actually get the information you require. Some of the simplified approaches may actually result in CSMs that are not at the levels where they should be. I actually feel it may actually result in too small a CSM. The problem with that is the CSM basically is largely where your profit emergence comes from. It also covers your overhead costs that can't be allocated sometimes to policies. So if your CSM is too small, you're really going to struggle to support, or your earnings in future just are going to be tiny relative to what others may expect. On the opposite of that, if your CSM is almost overcooked in size, you'll struggle actually to sustain those level of earnings that you're going to be reporting for the first few years. So the problem with this is you really want that sort of Goldilocks level of the CSM, which you're likely the most likely way to achieve is to actually do the whole shebang, but practically that actually may not be possible.
Henny van Wyk?
Yeah, I think very similar to that. I would imagine that for our newer products, we will try to do the whole shebang as it is, and because hopefully we would be able to get hold of that data and actually do it properly. Older products, I can't see that you can go back 30 years, 40 years to try to get the information. It is just too far in the past. So you'll have to do some kind of approximation to it. I mean, the third option is to go the fair value approach, but I think that is an option that one would definitely not want to do. I mean, your answers are going to be...
Why is that? Maybe just to...
I think your contractual service margin is just going to be totally too low. You're not going to show profits in the future. So. Yeah. Because your value that you put on liabilities is not what you expect somebody else to pay. It is actually more than that. Mm. So the idea is that you just hope you have enough data available to be able to do the sums that you want to do.
Mm. Yeah. Do you think you have that data?
I hope so. We will have to go and have a look there. We have lots of data available. obviously some of the information was not necessarily kept for all those years that you would hope you have it. But, I mean, for example, for our universal life products, we have the build-ups for many years. We don't necessarily have all the information for prospective reserves for all the years.
Yeah, yeah.
But we will dig as far as we can.
Yeah, but I think that's a common sort of theme, is that actually start collecting that information, start thinking about it now, and not just policyholder data, but assumptions, economic data. Yeah, so Quinton, have you guys found all of that data?
Yeah, I think the I mean, to add to the problems of on the old products, is especially the mergers that's gone through. So the legacy systems is sometimes legacy of legacy systems, and with each, you know, with each merger, I think the data is lost, and that data does not exist anymore.
Yeah.
So I think on the older products, especially on the legacy books, it is going to be a big challenge. And I think, as Michael has alluded to, the service margins that would typically correctly be attributed to those contracts is probably fairly sizable, given the nature of those contracts. So to not have any margin on those contracts, I think would be quite a big problem. So we'll have to look at that. On the newer generation products, I think we've created some of our own problems here, because I think the complexity of some of these products, and especially the options that we have allowed policyholders in terms of alterations, etc., will add to the complexity of the calculation of the service margin. So I don't think there's going to be it's not going to be a fun exercise. It is going to be a lot of data work and a lot of back testing. So I think, yeah, so maybe one of the reasons we've delayed this one is it's like going to the dentist. But yes, it's, I think, an important part to do.
Yeah, yeah. And Henny, your view?
Yeah, I think we share the same problems. I just recently read that there's now also a new disclosure requirement, in that you, for the contractual service margins that you've calculated on a full retrospective approach, that you've got to show those contractual service margins separate from the ones that you actually calculated on a simplified approach. So
right.
Just some further complexity that's added to the world. That one practical issue that I thought about is the fact that within the new contractual service margin, there's a very prescribed approach that will be used to run off to release profits in future. And that approach can be very different to the current approach that companies have used to release profits from their products. So I think if you get to that transition point, you can find for certain companies that release profits faster than the new requirements, that they could be in a position where they need to set up liabilities that are greater than the current liabilities that they hold, which will have a knock-on impact on their shareholder equity. You also have the reverse of companies that release profits slower than the new requirement, and they will be in the position where they have margins that they've not actually had as profit, but that will have to be transferred directly through to shareholder equity. So it will be quite interesting to see over the next few years, up to IFRS 4 implementation, whether companies actually start increasing or decreasing their discretionary margins to minimize the impact on transition. I'm sure that's something that the auditors will look at quite closely, just to see whether those actions are above board, but it does seem to be very penal not to be able to get margins on, ever to see margins coming through to profit, and that it immediately goes through into shareholder equity, but that could be an outcome.
Yeah. So, I mean, it seems, again, you know, it requires quite a bit of sort of thinking, actually looking at, you know, putting a hypothesis model in place and seeing how it behaves compared to what it did in the past or what you would like to sort of achieve. Okay, in the interest of time, I'll sort of skip to Jeremy to sort of close out on this question before.
Yeah, on this one, I think you just have to think about how much work is really needed. So, I mean, we're going to have to show three balance sheets when it goes live in, let's say, 1st of Jan 2020 for the sake of picking a date. And then that first date that you show it in, say, 2018, you're going to have to actually have this transition calculation goes all the way back. And to do that, then you need all the data, you need all the assumptions year by year, because you need to get the CSM year by year in the past, and you actually need your model to be built before you even do any of that. So you almost need to have built your whole solution, and then you can start transition. So there is quite a lot of dependency here in terms of the work required. And so you should really start looking at dependencies and what's being required, and you know, start looking at getting data assumptions now, and start thinking about, you know, where will it be impracticable for me to do the full retrospective method? When will I have to go to the approximate or simplified method? And when should I go to the fair value approach? Because the results may be different as well, depending on what point you switch from one method to the other.
Okay, great. I'll just do a quick sort of recap before opening the floor to some questions. You know, so the key themes that we said, and I have stolen Jeremy's words here, is around sort of starting early, start thinking about it, you know, having some teams of people sort of thinking about some of the concepts before, you know, because some of the concepts actually become more complex than you realize, you know, and the sooner one sort of starts, probably the better, you know, that one becomes aware of these complications. And then the other sort of theme is around effort being at least similar order of magnitude to SAM. The big change being the focus is on income statement or revenue, and also that theme of robustness and reliability. It's one thing producing an AOS or something that you produce to one sort of committee, but it's another thing when you're presenting it on your financials, audited, and all of management is, and shareholders are being incentivized and rewarded on that. You know, the speed and, you know, the amount of rigor that's required on some of those estimates is a different order of magnitude. And then also the sort of actuaries and accountants of working together sort of came out, and some of the other impact. And then finally on transition, you know, so quite a bit of work and effort around, you know, first the modeling, understanding what different options you have, what different impacts they have on your earnings profiles, both with new business but also for your in-force as it unfolds. And then the final thing that I raised, you know, sort of earlier is actually, you know, it's not going to be long before people are going to be wanting to get budgets or forecasts taking into account this sort of impact. Stakeholders, you know, shareholders, analysts will want to actually start understanding some of that sort of impact. Okay, so we've now just got just less than sort of 10 minutes available for, and this is actually the best part of this this panel. For once, as a chairman, I don't have to answer any questions. I can just lob it to the panel. So, looking out there, does anybody have any questions for our panel? Okay, I've got the usual thing. I've got at least one or two questions up my sleeve whilst you sort of think about it. One technical sort of area we haven't sort of you know, sort of thought about or sort of discussed much is the risk margin. You know, so is that risk margin the same as our SAM risk margin? Does it have to be? Do we want it to be? What impact does that have? And I don't know, Michael, you're smiling there, but that, no, actually, Quinton, you're just hiding Quinton. I think let's give this one to Quinton to have a think about.
So I had the privilege to be responsible for the drafting of the SAM technical specifications around the risk margin. And
you don't think there's no coincidence? Well, I'll ask you this question.
So, and I can remember the debates we had about the 6% and the prescription of the 6%. And I think very much the whole debate around IFRS will probably, again, evolve around that, because I think the approach for the calculation of the risk margin is sensible and is sound. There are other approaches, but I think it, you know, given the similarities with SAM, I think that's probably where we will tend towards. Yeah. But most of the debate will probably be around the 6% and what that rate should be, and the constituent parts of that and the linking of that to economic capital. So I think there's probably where most of the effort and work will go into with regards to the risk margin.
I do think that you can also include... You can also include a risk adjustment in respect of market risks. So it's not very well defined under IFRS. So there's obviously also then ways to try and look at your, try and manage your earnings profile by allowing for certain market risks and trying to
do that. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a key point. I don't know if you want to sort of expand on it. How by managing your risk margin or your what risks you included, can you impact on your earnings profile?
Well, I think if you look at the equity dampener currently under SAM, you could do something very similar where you could decide to increase your risk adjustment, but it's also obviously driven by market forces. You could increase your risk adjustment in times where the market equity market is high and reduce it at times when the equity market is low. That will also generate the natural smoothing of earnings. That's one option.
Let's just check. We don't have any auditors here, do we?
No, there's nothing. If it's a prescribed and set approach, then it is allowable. You can't, in my opinion, you just can't change from one valuation period to the next.
Looks like Michael's got some comment on this.
My view is the approach you may want to do it is actually quite different to a SAM approach, because you may have, with changes in the risk margin having to go through to the CSM, the calculation of the risk margin using the SAM approach for every single basis change you do is very complex. So maybe something similar to almost the, like a prescribed margin for each risk, like we currently have in IFRS, that's calibrated internally to what your risk is, what I think may be an easier approach. I think another area where almost lobbying is still required as a result of this huge flex given to risk margins so companies can follow whatever they want to do. Essentially, we have to disclose the confidence level of our liabilities over the lifetime of the liabilities. And in my view, that is a panacea of the number that we'd all like to have in terms of liabilities. It's just almost impossible to derive. So the general feeling is there, the only way we can lobby it is to go, well, we're going to disclose as much as possible to tell you how this risk margin's calculated, so that you can assess for yourself what the confidence level of liability is.
Okay. Great. We've got some hands out there. So, Andrew over there. Keep on thinking of questions.
Okay, I've got a question here while the mic's moving around. Oh. Is that right? Just a question regarding actuaries and accountants working together in the future. How do you see this panning out over the longer term? Currently, if I understand it correctly, accountants can produce a revenue statement without a lot of input from actuaries, but going forward they'll need a significant amount of input. And do you think over the longer term they'll be, or how do you see this panning out? Will they be looking at acquiring actuarial skills to produce our numbers? Or any comment on that, perhaps from Quentin? I think he raised the issue.
Yeah, I think the trick will be in the relationship between the different disciplines. I think the strength and skill set of the actuary is actually to derive, interpret, review the number, whereas the accountants are stronger at reporting those numbers. And I think we, like Michael has alluded to, we will probably have to work with our IT colleagues, etc., to build a process that facilitates the reporting of these numbers from our models into the financial reporting systems robustly, accurately, and quickly. I think the boundaries between the two disciplines will remain, but we will be much more involved with each other.
Andrew?
Some of the comments have been around one of the big differences between the work required for SAM, Solvency II, and this is that for smaller entities, you've got to do a proportional, probably a disproportionate amount of work. And it actually concerns me to the extent that should we as a profession be lobbying more? Because what I worry about is that the cost of reporting, both in terms of setting it up and the ongoing reporting for smaller entities, thinking of, you know, outside Africa or even smaller companies here, isn't actually in the public interest, given these costs of reporting on the businesses. I mean, you know, we sort of talk and joke around it being full employment of actuaries and that sort of thing. But at the same time, I can see a lot of work happening, you know, a lot more than we're doing for some, you know, for smaller sort of shows, because we have to comply with IFRS in those local environments. Actually, yeah. Why this is almost going to make the industry sort of sub-economic, because the overhead is going to be so big in terms of the additional work required.
Okay.
Is there any chance to do shortcuts? That's what it is.
Yes. So, Jeremy, you spoke to quite a bit about lobbying, and then Michael, you also sort of spoke. So, I don't know whether you've got any sort of perspectives on the effectiveness of lobbying, possibly.
Effectiveness of lobbying. Well, I think the more that different parties do lobby to the ISB, the more likely it is that those points will be heard. So I think the South African Actuarial Society has written some comments to ISB, and I know in Hong Kong they have as well, and various companies are directly writing letters as well. So the volume of letters that come in questioning certain aspects, I think, I guess it's more likely that they'll listen to it, just the sheer volume. Will warrant it, but I think the question was more around the impact on small companies, I think. So at the moment, with the companies that we've been working with in the Asian region, I mean, they're just expecting that they will have to roll this out. I mean, the large MNCs are thinking, even the small entities, that they're going to have to fully roll something out. And I guess, you know, there may be some companies in similar situations here where you may have a large South African base and some satellite offices throughout the rest of Africa. And I would imagine that at this stage, yes, you should be a little bit concerned about the effort that may be needed if you're not adopting a shared service type arrangement where you can actually get some leverage across making a change to a system centrally that can then be used effectively throughout the rest of the entities in Africa.
Okay. Sorry, we have, you know, sort of run out of time. Okay. Can we keep it as one very short question?
I just wanted to ask if anybody's considered the implications of IFRS 4 Phase 2 on our pricing, if there's a view on what those implications are, and given that majority, if not all, of our retail products we sell have terms that extend out beyond 2020, has any of the companies already been taking this into account in any way?
So I think Henny Miller actually sort of lobbed a slight question around pricing there. I don't know whether...
Not really something I thought of, but I would think that pricing is something that would be done kind of quite independently from your IFRS reporting. That just would be my very short answer. I don't know if any other views.
Yeah. I guess, you know, so the answer is how you're actually managing your business at the moment. If you're doing it on a sort of economic capital, you know, sort of risk-adjusted basis, hopefully, well, the profit ultimately sort of comes out. We have run out of time. We're about a minute or two over. I apologize for taking your time, but if you could just please give the panel a round of applause and thank them.